This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Go Home in a Box, your podcast source for all things genre films from the VHS era. We offer deep cut discussion of action, horror, and sci-fi films from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We also pay tribute to your nostalgic roamings through your favorite mom and pop video store, where you might remember finding that one treasure that has burned itself into your brain forever. Or maybe it's that lonely little box in the horror section that you turned your nose up at, because you were too good for a movie called Pumpkinhead. Shame on you, you snob. I am one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week we offer you a review of the 1977 horror tale Suspiria, directed by the great Italian filmmaker Dario Argento. You can get my thoughts on this film and others over at RetroMovieNerd.com. With me, as always, is your other grateful co-host. At least I hope he's grateful. He seems grateful. The ladies came to see him, and the guys want to be him. The Ayatollah of Pop Cultura, Joel LaPuma.
Am I the male Sable now? Is that what's going on?
You can make that anything you want. Yeah, that's your intro, Joel.
I appreciate that. And I'm usually the more of one, but I gotta say, your Pumpkinhead defense—that got pretty salty there.
Yeah, listen, if you're turning your nose up at Pumpkinhead, knowing what we know about that film, Joel, I mean, come on, that is the ultimate in snobbery, is it not?
No, it's a phenomenal movie, I've actually seen worse. I once saw someone turn up their nose at Let the Right One In because it was a vampire film.
I mean, come on. I mean, we're educating the masses here, aren't we, Joel?
We're trying to.
We're trying to give people a little slice of, you know, our world. I mean, we're movie lovers, and we love movies of all kinds, but especially these genre films. And you gotta take a bite of these movies that we're, running because there's good reason that we bring up a lot of films. It's just you gotta do it, you know.
I think we're gonna have to drag these respectable people kicking and screaming into civilization.
You know, it might be interesting if we could find someone who is not a fan of genre films and put them on the show and just, you know, educate them throughout. I don't know. Might be an interesting little style clash there.
If I knew anyone who wasn't into genre films, I think I've constructed my entire social circle around.
Yeah. You've created your little bubble there, and you don't.
I'm cut off.
Yeah, there are no snobs in your bubble.
But if I can one day find anyone like that, we'll get it.
Let's take a jaunt over to the new release section here, Joel, because we've got quite a hefty list to go through this week. Some interesting and notable releases from a few parties week. We'll start with one from the Warner Archive, coming out on DVD from 1989. It's Dead Bang, starring Don Johnson. He plays real life law enforcement hero named Jerry Beck. In this one, he's going after some biker gang / white supremacists in this film. It's directed by John Frankenheimer, so this is a notable film. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember it being a good piece of action. Not sure if you've seen it, Joel, but I recommend checking it out at least once.
It seems like it. It seems like it would be hard to go wrong with Frankenheimer doing doing just a classic cop fights white supremacist kind of action film.
Yeah,
and it looks like Jerry Beck. I'd like to read more about him because he was definitely heavily involved in the making of this.
Yeah, it's I believe it's actually based on an actual case that he worked. It's kind of like a true story, you know, dramatized for effect, of course, kind of giving it an action movie spin. But yeah, it's quite an interesting turn for Don Johnson there as well. Moving on from also from Warner, this one, you know, we don't really need to provide any background information on this one because it's a four movie set of the Lethal Weapon series. And if you don't know, if you never heard of Lethal Weapon, where have you been? Basically, Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, you know, I guess really they exploited the buddy cop trope. This is the prototypical buddy cop movie. And so they made four of them, and each one increasingly worse than the one before it. I mean, I think in each movie they pick up a new cast member with each movie. I mean, Lethal Weapon, it's just Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. Then in Lethal Weapon 2, they introduce Joe Pesci. Then in Lethal Weapon 3, they bring on Rene Russo. Till finally Chris Rock joins the fray in Lethal Weapon 4, and we've completely gone off the rails.
Four, I think, is most notable for that was the one where, like, just open racism joined the fray. that's the one with for our saner fans who haven't seen Four. That's the one where Jet Li is the villain, and there's a lot of Chinese jokes in there. It's very uncomfortable, especially in that the film made, what, 1998? It's not old.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of during, I guess, in near the beginning stages of the whole political correctness era that was introduced. I think it really came full-born in the 90s. But, yeah, definitely an interesting time capsule there of a different time because you definitely wouldn't have a lot of this in an action movie being made today. But, yeah, Lethal Weapon 1 through 4 from Warner coming out in one set.
What it's missing is Lethal Weapon 5 with the Always Sunny game.
You know, that might be an interesting take. You know, they could just remake Lethal Weapon 5, just recast everybody using the Sunny gang. That would make a hell of a movie.
Did you see Danny that episode?
Danny DeVito, yeah. I've actually caught part of it. I'm not a huge Sunny guy, but because I've kind of gotten away from television over the last few years. But I did see that, and it was hilarious. I thought it was pretty funny.
I thought it was a really just great classic. You know, Lethal Weapon is one of those films that I think, for me, just doesn't hold up very well. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just that the tropes got so overused over time. Yeah. Maybe it's knowing now what we know about Mel Gibson makes the whole thing kind of unfun.
Yeah, there might be a couple of factors in there. I still enjoy Lethal Weapon and the second one as well. But when we're starting to stretch it with Lethal Weapon 3 going forward from there. But, yeah, the buddy cop movie in 1987 when Lethal Weapon came out was really starting to get tired thanks to stuff like 48 Hours and Beverly Hills Cop. But you know, they made the most of it. And made themselves some good coin with this series.
Yeah, I think with Lethal Weapon, they had to be more of a buddy cop movie than anyone has ever been buddy cop movie in order to make it work, even at that fairly early stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's Shane Black, so of course, so when you want someone to make an action film way beyond, with a script way beyond any trope you've ever seen, like, hire Shane Black. When you want to take a trope to its absolute maximum extent, of what you could possibly do with it, he's the guy I call.
That's right.
I mean, I don't think you're gonna get a better buddy cop film and buddy cop film concept than the diplomatic immunity plot in Lethal Weapon 2.
Yeah, you know, that was kind of, you know, I mentioned I did like Lethal Weapon 2, but that one plot point was really a stickler for me because it kind of handcuffed the whole plot, you know?
Oh, totally. It's really difficult to work around, and I don't know if they really used it as well as they could, but it is a, you know, it's just such a great, it's such a great idea that I'd actually love to see someone else try it.
Yeah. Yeah. You can go for it. You know, there must be something more interesting that you can do with it, but, I would say, that would be, something to check out. What about, from Shout? Looks like we've got a couple of Shout/Scream releases this week, but, this one, the collector's edition Blu-ray of Trespass from 1992. It's Bill Paxton and William Sadler. They play a couple of firemen who find, a map in a burned out building that's supposed to lead to a hidden stash of gold. Unfortunately, the building where it's located is the headquarters of the gang of Mr. Ice-T. We'll call him Mister. And so it basically leads to a good chase through burned out ghetto with shootouts. It's a very underrated film, action film from the early 90s. So good to see Shout putting out a collector's edition Blu-ray for Trespass.
Yeah, it's not one I've seen, but I'm really curious about this, especially putting together Bill Paxton and William Sadler. I mean, both guys I like. It seems like a fun movie.
Yeah, tremendous fun, of course. You know, Ice-T was just starting to cut his teeth on the whole acting thing at this point in his career. I think this was during his body count days as well.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, the controversial Ice-T at this time. He's not so controversial anymore.
No, he's pretty gentrified.
I blame Coco. moving on, Blue Underground. They've a limited edition Blu-ray from them from 1972. It's Death Line, which in some circles is also known as Raw Meat. Donald Pleasance plays a Scotland Yard inspector looking into the disappearance of a politician, and he finds a subterranean subculture of cannibals. And so definitely kind of like an interesting forgotten film from the early 70s, that Blue Underground. They're very good at digging up from the vaults and polishing up nice and putting a nice new sheen on them and releasing them for us. And this definitely looks like something of interest.
Yeah, and that's one I know makes the rounds at horror fests on 35mm sometimes, usually under the title Raw Meat, but it's also the director Gary Sherman, who did Dead and Buried, Vice Squad, Poltergeist 3, Lisa. He's responsible for a lot of interesting or, you know, some not great films like Poltergeist 3, but a lot of fairly memorable genre flicks. I mean, Dead and Buried, I would say. I haven't seen Raw Meat yet, but I'm not sure it could possibly be better than Dead and Buried.
Yeah, Dead and Buried was, I've seen it one time, very interesting film. Poltergeist 3, I've seen that more than once, and whenever someone mentions Poltergeist 3, the one thing I can't get out of my head is everybody shouting Carol Ann, Carol Ann through like three quarters of the movie.
It's the precursor to Coral.
Oh, Coral, don't go in the barn. And of course, Coral goes in the barn.
Yeah, that show got old pretty fast.
We skipped the second Shout or Scream release this week. Coming out on Blu-ray from 1979, it's The Evictors, which is basically I guess we can call it a haunted house movie. It's a farmhouse that's protected from new ownership by spirits of its previous owners. Basically, the farmhouse is protected by these evil spirits. They do not want anyone else living in this farmhouse, and they do whatever they can to, you know, run the people off. Hence the title, The Evictors.
It's sort of a proto Beetlejuice, really. It's directed by Charles Pierce, who did Town That Dreaded Sundown. If I'm not mistaken, I think this was actually originally included as a bonus, like, feature on the DVD side of the Town That Dreaded Sundown release Scream Factory did.
Yeah, that would actually make a pretty decent double bill, you know, at your discount theaters.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I haven't seen it, but it's got a hell of a cast. I mean, Vic Morrow, Jessica Harper from Suspiria, and Phantom of Paradise, Shock Treatment, big fan of hers. Michael Parks, who I think most people would know is Sheriff Earl McGraw from all of the Tarantino Rodriguez films, from Dust Till Dawn, The Kill Bills. You know, just the sort of major recurring character in the Tarantino there.
Yeah, check out Michael Parks before he became a cult figure, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's looks like a pretty, I mean, yeah, it's hard to go wrong with Town That Dreaded Sundown, so I'm guessing this is going to be around the same level of quality there.
Yeah, I think The Evictors would, if you're looking for, you know, a lesser-known horror film to check out, then I guess you can't go wrong by recommending The Evictors. And then Vinegar Syndrome, our good friends of Vinegar Syndrome, have put out a Blu-ray DVD combo of the 1978 film Nurse Sherry. And basically the plot for this is a nurse named Sherry, possessed by the spirit of a dead preacher, who is out to exact revenge against those responsible for his death. So basically it's kind of like a possession revenge horror film.
Yeah, Scream's released a number of films along that line, most of which are pretty low, Z grade and insane and pretty wonderful. And I'm really excited about this one.
Yeah, me too. This is one that I need to seek out. I'm not familiar with this movie, and reading up on it, I was like, hey, you know, that's not too bad. That doesn't sound bad. I'll check that out. We're moving on to, I guess we got something from a company I'm not too familiar with. They're called SRS Cinema. Putting out a DVD of the 1986 film Truth or Dare. This is another horror film. Basically, the plot is a husband catches his wife cheating, and he just descends into insanity from there. He insists on playing a game of Truth or Dare with his victims, with, of course, bloodbath-like consequences. Definitely an 80s film that might have, I believe it has a bit of a cult following. Like I said, I haven't seen it, but you know, I'm a big fan of these more obscure 80s films, horror films, and this is one I need to check out.
Yeah, and this is one I think, like, in the video store, it's about 50-50 whether or not they put it in the horror or put it in the erotic thriller section. The director, Tim Ritter, looking at his IMDb earlier, it's nothing but that kind of film. This seems to have a little more respectability to it. Performance by a very young A.J. McLean from the Backstreet Boys.
Oh, boy.
Even before he was on Hi, Honey, I'm Home.
Oh, the Backstreet Boys. You've brought out some very horrible memories.
Listen, if you can't appreciate the Backstreet's back, I don't know what to tell you, man.
I cannot appreciate it, so therefore you do not know what to tell me.
You're killing me. I do not know what to tell you.
What about Lionsgate putting out on Blu-ray 1988 The Unholy? The Unholy Priest descends into a church where two priests have been murdered and evil must be dealt with. Ben Cross, Hal Brook is like a good cast.
Yeah, this is actually one I've seen. It, you know, it's not great. It's there's a lot of it's draggy. Pacing is not a big one. It's a watchable little film. Like if you were running a few films in one night, this would be a good like second film between a couple of other more exciting ones. Just as like a palate cleanser almost.
Okay.
It has its moments. It's not incredible though.
I've got a set. I believe there's 8 movies on it. The Unholy is included on there. I have not gotten around to watching all the films on this set just yet. It includes stuff like Waxwork and 976 Evil 2 and a few others. I think Chopping Mall is on there as well. And The Unholy is included on that set, but I haven't gotten around to watching The Unholy just yet. But, you know, this is a Blu-ray. And if you're a snob about film quality, then you'd probably rather have the Blu-ray than, you know, a small little nugget on, like, 2 discs. Check out The Unholy. I'm going to skip over one here, Joel, that you're interested in. Save it for last. But I wanted to go ahead and look at another Blu-ray coming out. It's an anime, a Japanese animated film from 1985 called Go Shogun, The Time Estranger. And I figured this might be of some interest to those who are into the 80s anime attempts, you know, stuff like Akira and Robotech and whatnot. This seems along the same lines as those films.
Yeah, from what I haven't seen the Go Shogun stuff, the show or this movie, but it seems like a pretty the show I think is more lighthearted than the movie from what I've gleaned. The movie is a bit more of a psychological take on the material. It seems like a good contemporary of like Space Runaway Ideon, more of the deconstructionist giant robot show that would lead to like Neon Genesis Evangelion, and my God, there were so many syllables in the things I just said. But this is the kind of thing people make fun of when they make fun of anime. But this really looks like a really cool, interesting, solid show. I really need to watch this at some point in the near future, because I'm a sucker for giant robot shows anyway.
Yeah, okay. You've got another release there, Joel, that we added at the last minute.
Oh yeah, it's a big week. We've got we've also got another Scream release that I think we both overlooked for a minute. The Four Skulls of Jonathan Drake.
Oh yeah, The Four Skulls of Jonathan Drake. You know what? It's interesting because that was just on Comet TV over the past week, so I did catch some of that. From 1959, it's kind of like a voodoo, shrunken head, curse type horror film. I totally skipped over that.
It's a packed week. There's a lot of stuff I missed at first glance because Criterion also has The Lodger, which is a silent Hitchcock thriller from 1927.
Yeah, I'm familiar. I had that on a Hitchcock collection that I had at one time, and so I have seen that one. That's a very good one.
And I'm not sure if this is his earliest surviving film or not, but it's his third or fourth picture. I think third. His third film ever. So for Hitchcock fans, I'm sure this is a pretty like invaluable release. I'm not a huge Hitchcock fan, but you know, I'd be curious to see this just for the notability of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and also from Arrow, we have a really nice special edition DVD and Blu-ray of Kenji Fukasaku's Doberman Cop, starring Sonny Chiba, which is based on a manga I haven't read from the creator of Fist of the North Star. It looks like a pretty great sort of action comedy. Yeah, I'm a huge Fukasaku fan, so this is definitely a gap in his filmography for me. I really need to see this. And he worked with Chiba on a number of other things, including some of the Yakuza Papers, Battles Without Honor and Humanity series. So, I mean, this seems like Chiba at his most insane, badass best.
Yeah, and for those who are familiar with the name Sonny Chiba, of course, they probably know him as the Street Fighter, the early 70s, martial arts films. Very cult favorites. So Sonny Chiba, if you're looking for something different from Sonny Chiba, then this would be the movie to check out.
Yeah, I think he's such a good match for Fukuzaku's style. I mean, he's got such an intense but weird energy to him, and it matches Kenji's stuff just so spot on.
Yeah, awesome. Last but certainly not least in our hearts, Joel.
Oh, Kino, foremost in my heart.
Yeah, Kino Lorber is putting out a Blu-ray of 1980s, let's just say it's a canon, of course, and it's their attempt at the rock and roll, sci-fi, throw everything at the wall and see what sticks genre. It's the Apple.
Apple.
Yeah, the Apple. It's the Apple, not any Apple. This is the Apple.
The sacred Apple.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
This is the ultimate trash musical. I mean, it's canon, and it is Menachem Golan directing this, and trying to do his version of Tommy.
Exactly. Yeah, they were thinking that this was going to be their Tommy, their big. And it was supposed to be the big breakthrough for Canon as well. They poured a lot of money into it.
Oh, they did. It was supposed to be their, their entry into respectability. I mean, if you're into, trash sci-fi musicals, Xanadu, or even like good rock and roll insanity, like Paradise, Apple is not one you can afford to miss.
Yeah. Exactly. So and finally, it's getting a wide release from Kino Lorber on Blu-ray, and that's probably the best way that you're going to check this film out. And I know I've seen some pretty bad copies of the Apple out there, so hopefully this Blu-ray release wipes the slate clean for this and gives us something that we can really appreciate.
We can finally get the version of the Apple we've always deserved.
Do we really deserve it?
No one really deserves it. The most we can hope is to work towards it.
Exactly. Well, quite a hefty release week this week. A lot of choices. I know my purse strings are pretty tight, so I'm just going to have to be more discerning. I think I'm going to check out this version of the Apple for sure. And it's time to move on to our main topic. A little something that a little something that I call 1970s drive-in massacre. And we're going to look at films from the 1970s, exploitation films, however you want to call them, drive-in movies. They have so many different ways to describe them. But basically, your exploitation film is basically a film that attempts to succeed, not necessarily financially, but just to exploit things like current trends or, include some lurid content in there. They're generally low-quality B-movies. They still, do things like attract cult followings. Probably the biggest one that stands out is something like Night of the Living Dead from 1968. It that film set a trend, and it is historically important, but there are other films that probably do not follow that path that Night of the Living Dead had. A little bit of history on them. They feature things like suggestive or explicit sex, or there's sensational violence, drug use, nudity, freaks. You got your freaks. There's plenty of gore, just bizarre stuff, mayhem, rebellion, all throughout movies such as these. In your pre code days, you had such as the film, Reefer Madness would be one that we'd throw in there. You know, have you seen Reefer Madness, Joel?
I love Reefer Madness. And actually, I haven't seen it yet, but there's a musical of Reefer Madness that I'm pretty sure got made into a film. I know Roxy's a big fan of it, and I've been interested in checking that one out for a while.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Reefer Madness, the musical.
And that's more recent. I believe that might have Kristen Chenoweth, who's a pretty big Broadway star in it.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a parody of Reefer Madness. It's not going at it straight, saying marijuana is going to cause you to flip out PCP style and throw yourself through a window.
I love movie scenes where people are throwing themselves through windows. That's just something about someone intentionally throwing themselves through a window or even maniacally doing it. It just cracks me up every time I see it. I don't care what the situation is. It could be a straight up, serious horror film, and I'm going to laugh out loud at someone throwing themselves through a window.
Do you have RoboCop on at your house like 24/7?
Actually, I do. What are you doing peeping in my windows?
Well, it's a sinful dwarf kind of thing to do, I figured.
we talk about exploitation films, and they were relegated at the time to grindhouse theaters and drive-ins. They call them grindhouse because I think it stemmed from the fact that you had all these movie theaters, say, in New York City on, 42nd Street, and they were all these, burlesque-type theaters, and they went defunct, and they decided to make some money off them and start showing these low-budget, exploitation films. And so the term grindhouse, I think, really... the old bump and grind burlesque. I really think the term came from that in terms of why they're called, grindhouse theaters. And, of course, the drive-in movie theater, that was probably at its peak in the 50s and maybe part of the 60s. And, it started to decline maybe some in the 70s, and theater owners began to look for ways to bring more people in. So they decided to book these more... films from the exploitation genre here within. So it kind of extended the stay of the drive-in movie theater by showing some of these more notorious films. And, Joel, we've got different subgenres to look at here. I mean, what would you include in an exploitation genre, a subgenre of exploitation film? Like you got the biker movie, right?
There's the biker and gang movies. I mean, of course, that's a huge component, especially after the success of Easy Rider in the 60s, but became something much more, much seedier, after the gangs like the Hell's Angels became notable in just mainstream culture. Of course, grindhouse theaters were big on kung fu films, real chop-socky kind of stuff. Blaxploitation, huge. Various exploitations.
If it had exploitation, then you had a movie for it. I mean, you've got you've got your cannibal films,
your nun-sploitation.
Nazi-sploitation.
Yes.
I don't know, sexploitation, and there's even, my roots, I'm Canadian, there's even something called Canucksploitation.
Yeah, any film industry with from a specific nation with, more independent and grindy element. I mean, Ozploitation is big, stuff like Mad Max and guys like Brian Trenchard Smith, I mean, they even did that, documentary on it a few years back, Not Quite Hollywood. Those tend to be the labels that get used most often. I don't know why in particular Australia and Canada get that, where say Italy doesn't necessarily get that, like Italian genres aren't classified under just Italian exploitation. They're you know, giallos, and there's splatter films, spaghetti western, zombie films. So I don't know in particular why. Maybe it's just whenever there's a real central film in it, like in the film scene, like because I mean with like Australia, it was a relatively small number of guys doing most of these films and working on each other's films, working on like helping each other edit their films, like put together trailers. Like, you know, Brian Trenchard-Smith, for instance, like was the one who edited the trailer for Patrick. I don't think he worked on the film itself, but like it was a really linked together film scene. Like, I don't know, something like Singapore was, you know, I'm sure at some point, at various points, the Canadian like genre scene was before Canada started doing that whole tax credit scheme to get American productions to film there.
Right. You know, Canada in the 70s was, it was really a surprising number of well-known films to come out of, you know, Canada in the 70s. You know, you've got your Black Christmas, you've got, directed by, the same guy who directed A Christmas Story, Bob Clark. He's from my neck of the woods. He was actually, born in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, and I'm just a few miles from outside there. So, and then you've got, there was another one. Oh, David Cronenberg's Shivers was another one, filmed in and around Montreal. And there was also another one I just saw recently, The Picks, or also known as The Hooker Cult Murders, with Christopher Plummer and Karen Black. These are some of the more well-known films that come out of Canada in the 70s, and hence, you know, you got your term for Canucksploitation.
Yeah, really interesting scene coming out of Canada then. I mean, yeah, there are so many subgenres and sub-subgenres of exploitation. Like, any time there was any kind of trend in the 70s, I mean, there's trucker exploitation, there's redneck exploitation, you know, like, they were trying to leech off the popularity of things like Dukes of Hazzard or the, you know, the song Convoy. I mean, they got a whole movie out of that. You know, there's various new genres, nudie cuties, which are, and nudist films in general, most of which are skirting production code restrictions by purporting to be documentaries about the nudist lifestyle, and of course only showing attractive people, mostly women nude.
Yeah, of course. I've never been to a nude beach or a nudist colony or anything like that, but whenever I've seen something like that on television, it's always people in their 50s or 60s, you know, beyond their good years, who are walking around, you know, completely nude.
Yeah, no shame in their game.
Yeah.
You know, you're that age, you don't care anymore. It's awesome.
There's, you could even move into even, you know, the current era, with your mockbusters, thanks to, you know, a company like The Asylum.
Oh yeah.
You know, they always tend to release their movies just in front of, you know, whatever the big summer blockbuster is. You know, for instance, like and the titles are always something really close to what the big blockbuster title is.
Yeah, I mean, and even things like that were even happening back in this era. I mean, you know, Charlie's Angels gets huge. You get a ton of films about special ops teams of women with various specialties, like teaming up together. Angel's Revenge by Graydon Clark, I always think of, because that's the one where as a kid I really thought that was just like a Charlie's Angels TV movie or something. When I first saw it on MSD.
Yeah, you get the Doll Squad.
Yeah, like all the Ted DeMichels. I mean, Sergio Santiago did a lot of this stuff. And this all first ties into the genre we haven't mentioned, which is Woman in Prison.
Oh yeah, that's I was actually quite one of the, I guess one of the bigger trends in the 70s exploitation genre and was, you know, the womenism films.
And that goes back even farther than, like, I think most people realize. I mean, there's womenism films made by reputable film companies, like back in the 50s even. I mean, you've got stuff like it was like Caged. There's a bunch of them from the 50s and 60s. Caged is the one that always stands out because that had a actually really respectable cast. Eleanor Parker was in it, Agnes Moorehead, and I think was actually originally going to be a Betty Davis and Joan Crawford film, but the lesbian undertones kept them away from it. But it actually got nominated for some Academy Awards. It was a quality film, and it got nominated for acting awards. And, you know, at the time, that's not a surprise. I mean, that was like a year after Jules Dassin did Brute Force. I mean, prison narratives were not as like exploited then as they would necessarily be considered. They are more morality plays than anything that far back. You know, by the time you get to the 70s with Sergio Santiago's stuff, with Jack Hill's stuff,
Yeah, you see, it actually becomes more about, you know, how soon can we get them to strip naked?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, it's a genre that almost comes pre-sarcastic. Like, I mean, Jonathan Demme did, like, The Hot Box and Caged Heat, and they're clearly very tongue-in-cheek films, and that's, like, early on in the trend, really.
Yeah. And so, I mean, as we're going through these different subgenres of, you know, exploitation cinema, you see, one thing we need to mention real quick is after the death of Bruce Lee, we had what we call Bruceploitation. Yeah, with, you know, the guys that kind of look like Bruce Lee, but you knew weren't Bruce Lee. Who do we have? We had Bruce Lee, we had Bruce Lee, we had... it's just funny the different variations on the guy's name too.
I mean, and here's an interesting thing. At one point there were talks. I don't know how far any like planning actually got. They've sort of shrouded in legend. There was apparently going to be a Bruce Lee as in Bruce L.I. Film pitting him against Ilsa.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
I'm not sure.
Watching those two genres come together like that, man.
Yeah, I would have killed for more of those mashups in that era. I mean, we really. Yeah. I'm shocked that I don't know if it was just the very independent nature of these productions and the sort of fly by night nature of a lot of the production companies, but it feels like the one place that that the films of this era didn't really go. Is the mashup film. We got that briefly with like Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, the Hammer Shaw Brothers crossover from 74 or so. Unfortunately, that may have killed it because that ended up being a real money loser for Hammer. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't get that. Come on, it's vampires, it's kung fu. Go see it.
It's a real shame, and I believe there was supposed to be like a Loch Ness crossover, like based on the Loch Ness monster between Toho and God. I think it may have been Hammer.
Yeah, I think. And don't forget, we had all the Bruce Lee, I guess, actors, but martial arts experts. Calling them actors is kind of, kind of giving them credit. But there's a movie called The Clones of Bruce Lee that brings all these Bruce Lee ripoff artists together in one movie. And they're actually, the plot is they're actually cloned from Bruce Lee's DNA. And eventually there is a scene in the movie where three of them fight each other. And it's actually, the payoff, unfortunately, is not worth sitting through 80 minutes of nonstop, you know, senseless, meaningless kung fu action. But it was definitely made. All these Bruce Lee clones were brought together in one movie.
I think we might have different definitions of meaningless, but I'll for now defer to your judgment on this. But I have to correct myself. The Toho Hammer film was going to be called Nessie. There are some concept art and some pre-release posters out there. It was fairly close to going in production. I don't know why it wasn't put together. It might have just been Hammer's monetary issues. It might have been Toho being difficult to work with, which sometimes they are. So, which is a shame that we could have had all the before, you know, the era of shared universes. Like we could have had like a lot of different interesting mashup films. Actually, I know one of the films De Laurentiis was thinking about after acquiring the King Kong rights was Orca versus King Kong.
Man. You're killing me with these possibilities.
I know.
Oh my gosh. I mean, we had King Kong and Godzilla mashup in the 60s. I mean, I don't think it was very good, but just the idea of King Kong meeting Godzilla, and then that's what they're doing now with Kong Skull Island and the Godzilla, another Godzilla reboot, and they're creating a universe for these two to meet up, and I mean, I'm appreciative of the effort, but it was done before, probably not as well budget-wise, but it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, I'm hoping it. You know, I didn't see the new Godzilla because, you know, it just seemed very human-centric, and that's not really what I'm looking for in my Godzilla films, especially when when you kill off the only actor I could possibly care about in the entire movie, like a third of the way into it.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, I didn't see Skull Island either, and that had a cast that actually interested me, so if, you know, if that cast is returning, it might be worth a look.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I've got my eyes tuned on this thing. I haven't caught Kong Skull Island yet, but definitely plan on seeing that here soon, because it's always had my interest since it was released. But, yeah, so anyway, you know, the idea of, you know, these mashups, of course, is not new, but now they definitely have the potential to do them better than they had in the past.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the opportunity there. It seems like the studios are more willing to either work with each other or just buy the rights to the thing they want, to make money off of.
Right. And so now as we get back to our exploitation films of the 70s, Joel and I have come up with a list of films that we want to recommend. And they cross-reference the different subgenres of the exploitation cinema, and so we've got a good cross section of films here that we want to go through and recommend that you see. And these are probably one of the typical films that you'll find in the subgenres. And so we chose them carefully, and we think we've got a good comprehensive list for you to check out. And I think, Joel, I think what we'll do is you kick it off with any one of your movies that you want to choose here, and just give us a little details on it.
Well, let's start off then. So we were talking about you know, kung fu being a part of the genre. We were talking about the Bruce Lee, the Bruce exploitation. Let's start off with a pretty accessible kung fu film that I like to suggest for people whenever they're asking, like, what's a good one to just start with? Sister Street Fighter.
Ah, Sister Street Fighter.
And, you know, this is a you don't need to have seen, you know, the Street Fighter beforehand. It's just a spinoff. Sonny Chiba's there, but, you know, he's just sort of along for the ride. He's just sort of the cavalry in this one. You know, it's all about, it's just, it's an extremely colorful film. like kung fu films often. It's almost an interesting thing. When I see, look at kung fu films, I almost like divide it between the Shaw brothers and everything that's not the Shaw brothers, because the Shaw style, like, they're very fun films, but they're also tonally they're very consistent. They can be very serious a lot of the time, even though there's humor and romance usually in a lot of them. But they're very there's a reasonable standard of quality and sort of a lack of ridiculousness. I mean, there's big action scenes in the Shaw Brothers, like maybe some crazy stunts and stuff, but they're not really grindy. They're almost too respectable for that. Like, Sister Street Fighter is a grindy film. It feels like a comic book. You know, she's fighting like a drug lord who has like just hanging out in a fortress with a harem and just like an entourage of gimmicky martial artists. Like, right. You know, it's not just like faceless moots. They all have their own gimmicks. Like, he's running a pro wrestling stable.
Yeah, exactly. It's very pulpy, very cartoony.
Almost. Yeah, he's hanging out around a pool, like, you know, getting on with woman from his harem. Well, crazy martial artists are practicing with exotic weapons all around him. It's just like a perfect dumb kung fu film.
Yeah. And that's a great choice. And I think it's, you know, it's representative of the chop-socky martial arts, you know, exploitation film here, especially with the... it kind of has that feel because of the female lead. You know, you think there's probably the chance of some sexploitation in something like this, but no, not really. It's more about the martial arts and as the way it should be. You know, because women can kick ass too. They don't just have to get naked. You know, so I think that's definitely a good choice, representative of that subgenre.
Yeah, it's not like, I mean, there are martial arts films that get into like the sexploitation stuff, but I mean, you know, with Chiba, with Etsuko Shihomi, you know, the Sister Street Fighter, they work together a lot. They, you know, they started together in Sonny Chiba's Dragon Princess and Kenji Fukasaku's Message from Space. I mean, they're just an awesome pair that it's just fun watching them work together.
Well, I'm looking at, you know, the biker subgenre, and the film I have in mind, it kind of, there's a couple of different tropes, I guess, so to speak, running through this film. I'm going with a movie that's probably best known under the title Savage Abduction, also known as The Bloody Slaying of Sarah Rhinelander, but also known as Psycho. Yeah, and so a lot of these movies, you'll see, they went through title changes for things like being shown on television. And, yeah, I mean, you couldn't, you probably couldn't show a lot of these movies. It had to be edited for television, so they had to change the title, you know, something that could be shown, you know, without, you know, making any waves and whatnot. But what this is the movie, and it kind of has different tones throughout the film. The movie starts off with a man hiring someone to kill his wife. So the story shifts focus on from the guy who's doing the hiring to the killer. Now, the killer is a psychopath. He's got some mental problems, of course, and he likes to carry a suitcase around with him where he carries the tools of his trade. So he kills the man's wife. The story shifts focus to the killer, who now is blackmailing the first guy into finding more women for him to kill. He really gets off on murdering women. And so now the story shifts focus to the first guy again and his hunt for a couple of more women. And he's a lawyer, so he knows some criminals, and so he goes to the leader of a biker gang who he's represented before, and asks him to find some women for him. And so now the story shifts focus once again to the bike gang and their search for two women. And this takes us to another story shift. You see what's going on. You see the trend here. We've got a plot that doesn't really have much focus, but we've got two young, innocent women just walking the street. And they're picked up by a couple of members of the bike gang, and they take them back to their headquarters and promising them a party. But they're really held captive. And so now we've got the women in captivity trope, and the movie now is really about how are these women going to get away from their bike, from this bike gang, and they don't know what's in store for them. And so towards the end of the movie, the killer is finally brought to the women, and it just goes off the rails from there. There is no protagonist in this film. Everyone, you know, even the women are portrayed as helpless victims. They're not really heroines in the film at all. And so we really have a movie without a good guy. And in the end, I don't want to give too much away, but in the end, the original guy, the guy who paid someone to kill his wife, is kind of walks away from this as kind of a hero. And so it's an interesting film. You've got your bike gang in there, you've got your maniacal killer, you've got women in captivity, you've got all kinds of stuff going on in this film. Not a lot of cohesion in terms of plot, but just the fact that it's it is definitely a product of its era makes this one worth, I believe, checking out, because it does get quite insane a few times in the movie, especially when it pertains to the psycho killer.
Yeah, and this is a nice representative choice. I haven't seen it, but so much of what you're pointing out. You know, we talked about mashups in the sense that you think of them as like iconic characters coming together or shared universe stuff. Wasn't really happening then, but, you know, mashups of tone where you say, all right, we're going to do a biker film, but we need something else because people have seen biker films already. So you add in sort of a strangers on a train plot line where, you know, you're hiring killers to murder your wife, and then, you know, it sort of transmogrifies into, oh, now it's a psycho killer movie with some bikers in the background. Like, that's common in a lot of these because so many of them are sort of written to fill like a perceived niche. You know, especially once you're getting like really deep into like a trend that's just getting exploited over and over. Because I mean, this is fairly late for a biker film. Like, you know, by the point John Lawrence directed this, and he also produced and wrote one of my favorite biker films, The Glory Stompers, with Dennis Hopper, and that's like 6 years before Cycle Psycho. I mean, that's, I think, the same year Born Losers by Tom Laughlin, Billy Jack himself, came out. You know, it's like probably about 7-8 years after the Wild Angels came out. I mean, this territory's been mined so many times. I mean, even a couple of years before Cycle Psycho, God, no wonder it's known as Savage Abduction. Even a couple of years before that, I think, is Psychomania, also known as the Death Wheelers, which is about...
Yeah, the Death Wheelers,
yeah,
yes.
The immortal zombie cyclist, which is an awesome, awesome film. So you've got, like, trying to continuously exploit a trend and just finding more and more batshit ways to do it.
Exactly.
And also another trope of this era is, of course, the multiple titles for the same film, partly for TV viewing. I think probably a lot of it is just they keep the same film can repeatedly make the drive-in circuit or the grindhouse circuit under different titles, or sometimes like different distribution companies will buy the rights to a different film, or, you know, one distribution company will go out of business, another one will pick it up, retitle it, and send it around. I mean, that's one of the like on the meta level, one of the interesting things for me about this era and genre of film that like you have to pick through so much like refuse just to find what the hell you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to track down some of these films because they change titles so much, but you know, that's why you know, the Internet Movie Database or IMDb comes in handy, because searching for one title will inevitably lead you to the title that that the movie is probably best known under.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a really interesting search, just following the distribution histories of these films. I mean, so many of these are regional productions, so as they went to the country region by region to different driving, sometimes they would change the title based on just what was popular in a certain area. You know, it's just kind of an interesting game that's going on with trying to like squeeze every penny out of this marginal film as possible.
Well, and that's going to lead into, I'll get another choice in here, Joel, and then you can jump in with your second choice. But that's going to lead me into the next choice on my list, which is still, you know, it still contains, you know, a biker gang. We're going with The No Mercy Man from 1973. Now, this is also... can be found, this is another case of, you know, title changes. This is also known as Train to Kill USA. The No Mercy Man, basically a Vietnam vet returns home from the war. He's got post-traumatic stress disorder. So he's got, you know, all kinds of stuff going on upstairs that, you know, he's not proud of. And we've got some carnies in town. Some evil carnies that just want to rob and loot the place. They hook up, they team up with a biker gang led by Sid Haig. Yeah, the notorious B-movie film star Sid Haig. So we've got carnies teaming up with biker gangs to take on Vietnam War veterans, one of whom is suffering greatly from post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is this was a satisfying film for me. You know, the main character, he doesn't do much of it. He does a lot of sitting around and moping and drinking, you know, just trying to forget his, you know, just trying to chase away his demons. You know, he's got issues between him and his dad. His dad thinks he should just, you know, he thinks he can just shake it off, but it's not that easy, Dad. And you know, the carnies, they know that the dad has a loot of weapons, you know, a cache of weapons inside of him, because he's one of those dads. He's, you know, I guess we'll call him what do they call him now? The Trump supporters, yeah.
We're gonna get doxxed.
Well, he's got a house full of guns, and the carnies want the guns so they can go and rob the bank, the big bank downtown. Of course, the satisfying part of all this is, you know, at the height, he's the son, the PTSD sufferer, does not break into action until like the last 10 minutes of the movie, and then he's just a one man gang through the whole thing. It was pretty cool. You know, it's just like, when is he going to do something? His family's getting beat up. His sister's on the verge of getting raped. Come on, man, do something. And finally, he just busts through the barn door, and it's time to just kick some ass. And so I thought it was a quite satisfying film. And this is a favorite of one Quentin Tarantino as well. And he's actually revived it for some screenings in the past. And I think there's another one that, you know, it's worth seeking out.
Yeah, and I believe we mentioned this this in our canon in our canon episode.
Yeah, that's right. That was before Golan and Globus took over. This was very early
canon. Yeah, very early canon distribution. And if I recall, this had Dean Cundey, you know, one of the all-time great cinematographers, on camera work. So it's worth, I mean, just to see an early film of his is definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. The No Mercy Man, a.k.a. Trained to Kill USA. That's Trained to Kill USA actually sounds like a movie that a Trump supporter would make, doesn't it?
Oh, my God.
I'm just having fun. Man.
We're going to have to deal with these people now. We're gonna get like sent all these Breitbart links about these like weird crime statistics someone made up about Sweden since they started letting Muslims in.
Yeah, you know, we're just I'm sorry, but we need to talk about more than just like Tim Allen's last TV show, Last Man Standing. We need to move on, and. This is the way to do it.
Moving on from our loss of Tim Allen sitcoms.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, from biker, one of the genres I think we neglected to mention, because it typically is more of a Hollywood thing, a bit more respectable, is the car chase exploitation genre.
Oh, I guess we can call it car exploitation, right?
Yeah, I mean. It's one of those genres that I think sort of straddles the line between Hollywood and independent film in the 60s and 70s. You know, usually you'll see better actors, slightly higher budgets. You know, my favorite the entire genre is Dirty Mary Crazy Larry from 1974.
Yeah,
which is a good one. Just a phenomenal film. I mean, the cast just. Peter Fonda and Susan George, Vic Morrow, Kenneth Toby, really standout role by an otherwise fairly obscure actor, Adam Rourke, who I think probably is actually a veteran of the biker genre. He did Hell's Angels on Wheels. He did The Losers, also known as Nam's Angels. And later he was a supporting actor in The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole and Steve Railsback, which is really one of the more overlooked, genuinely great films from the past, you know, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, The Stuntman's pretty good. I enjoy it.
It's just phenomenally performing. It's just great performances all around. It's just a great movie. But, yeah, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry is also, I would say, just a genuinely great film. I mean, you know, it's a heist gone wrong that turns into, extremely, like, a movie-long car chase, basically. You know, some of the greatest car stuff you'll ever see, not just in the stunts themselves, but in the editing. You know, there's no soundtrack to this, which is really interesting. There's a theme song over the opening and closing titles. You get a little music on the radio at various points, but it's just the sound. It's just natural sounds.
It's just the sound of engines roaring and tires squealing. And,
This is directed by, I think, honestly, one of the really more, I keep saying everything's overlooked, but one of the more overlooked directors from this era, John Howe, who did probably best known for Escape to Witch Mountain and Return from Witch Mountain, Watcher in the Woods, he did for all of those for Disney, and, you know, a film, one of my favorite ghost stories that Scream Factory released some time ago, The Legend of Hell House with Roddy McDowell.
Yeah.
And he's just a really flexible director, good at a lot of different genres. Great at cinematography, great at editing stuff together. I mean, really fantastic at just putting sequences together using, like, really visual notable elements that aren't necessarily standout elements on their own, but when
when you put it together, and you know, doing a car chase film has its own set of difficulties. Like working with subtle elements is obviously not one of them. It's not like Legend of Hell House where he's taking smaller things and gradually building them together to bring the film to a crescendo. But this is a film where, you know, it's so much about obsession. It's about being totally down on your luck and trying to go out. Trying to grasp that anything you can, you know, from a system that feels like it's been holding you down all this time. And it's obsession on every side because Vic Morrow, his police captain, is obsessed with like catching Peter Fonda. I mean, there's this amazing sequence at the end where he's got no resources left. Like all the cars he's sent after them are completely trashed, but he's on the radio calling out these locations and orders, and he's basically convincing Peter Fonda to outdrive himself, and it's some of the most incredible stuff you'll ever see in a car film. It's just a phenomenal movie.
Yeah, I think definitely the car exploitation genre, you know, it had its peak in the 70s because not just Dirty Mary and Crazy Larry, but you had you know, Death Race 2000, Gone in 60 Seconds.
The Driver. I mean, all of this is coming partly because there was such a movement after, you know, after Bullet and after French Connection. I mean, there's such a movement towards doing bigger and bigger car stuff.
Just putting these muscle cars into action. Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, I think definitely you hit on it there. It's definitely the front runner in the car exploitation genre in terms of just, you know, straight up chase action. So that's definitely a good recommendation there for that little subgenre there. I think what we're going to do, Joel, let's take a break here for a moment. And when we come back, we'll list some more of our favorites in the exploitation subgenres, including we'll get into a few blaxploitation features. I think we've got an example of a Mondo film in there, and we've even got a couple of killer animal movies to get to. So I think we'll take a break, listen to this short 3-4 minute promo for a few moments, and when we come back on the other side, we'll rhyme off a few more. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all these shows, plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacy and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Well, we're back, and thank you for hanging in there during the break. We're talking 70s Drive-In Massacre, which is just another way of saying we're talking 70s era exploitation films. We've gone through a little bit of a backstory of the exploitation genre, as well as some of its subgenres. And Joel and I now are in the midst of offering up some recommendations. We've gone through, Joel's given us Sister Street Fighter, Dirty Mary Crazy Larry. I've offered up Cycle Psycho and its numerous titles, as well as the No Mercy Man. And so now I think we're going to get into one of the staples of the exploitation genre, the subgenre, rather, was blaxploitation. And I think we've got a couple here. Kick us off with that, Joel.
Absolutely. And to go back a little bit, we were talking earlier about how this scene, this genre, this era of film came to be. And one of the things that's happening, there's a few things going into it. The first is that it's about choice. Like, we're still in an era where there's no cable television. There's it's nascent days of cable television, very early in that era, when we're getting into, the mid-late 70s. Theaters are still either grindy affairs or they're bigger theaters, typically owned by movie studios. That starts changing once you get into the 60s. When a lot of these studios are having major monetary difficulties, they just can't figure out what to sell to people. Every time there's a hit, they will mercilessly give you the same thing over and over and over again. There's an entire book that I wholeheartedly recommend, Roadshow, which is about the fall of movie musicals in the 60s, how after The Sound of Music came out, every studio wanted their Sound of Music, so they would do these huge engagements where all these films were exceptionally long, like 2.5 hours or more, and they would send them out on the country in big roadshow engagements where you'd have like intermissions, and they'd be like higher ticket prices because these were events and not just films. And of course, Sound of Music ended up being kind of a singular thing, and a lot of these films ended up being kind of bad to begin with. So, studios just don't know how to capture an audience that is getting what they need from television, which is the third big element of this, that, television is giving them more choice. We're not quite fully into the cable era yet, but even with just network television, they're getting options here. But one of the you know, major audiences not getting served by even television for the most part. I mean, there's elements of it, but you know, we're starting to get shows like, say, The Jeffersons, What's Happening, things like that are starting to come about. But, you know, the black audience in America is not getting much in terms of visual entertainment. I mean, yeah, music, sure, but, I mean, we're deep into, like, we're deep into a great R&B soul era, but, you know, so exploitation filmmakers are really serving a totally, like, underserved populace, giving them films like with, even if a lot of these filmmakers were white, giving them films with black casts, with, you know, set realistically in actual urban locations in places in New York and Chicago and LA, like filming on site rather than on a studio lot. So, and a lot of these films, you know, I mean, of course, there's your Foxy Browns and your Shafts. Like, there's action films, there's detective films, crime films, like you would expect, real wish fulfillment stuff. And there's even like kung fu films, like Black Belt Jones with Jim Kelly of Enter the Dragon fame. But sort of the most interesting thread of these for me is the blaxploitation horror thread, where a lot of classic horror stories were reimagined with black casts, with themes that were more accessible to black audiences. One I'm a big fan of is J.D.'s Revenge.
Oh, J.D.'s Revenge, yes, sir.
Which stars Glenn Turman, who a lot of people might know from Cooley High, which is one of the all-time great coming-of-age films.
He was in Gremlins, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
Really good actor. I mean, you had great lead actor here. Louis Gossett Jr. is one of the main supporting characters. Directed by Arthur Marx, who gave us Friday Foster, Detroit 9000, you know, a lot of classic films from this era. And it's just basically a black Jekyll and Hyde tale, only, you know, modernized, like, you know, the spirit of J.D. Walker. He was a gangster in, like, not quite the Prohibition era, but he's definitely, it's a little anachronistic. I mean, it's post-Prohibition, but he's dressed in, like, Isaac, Glenn Turman's character, who gets, you know, taken over. He's dressing like zoot suits, like, real gaudy gangster clothing. And, you know, by giving it that level, I mean, Jekyll and Hyde is, of course, a classic story. It's always been an interesting story that is really adaptable to different times and places. So, you know, but doing it here, there's elements of, like, with the backstory they're given, that he was a gangster who got set up, that there's subtext of urban decay, like when Isaac starts getting taken over, there's a lot of drug use metaphors, there's a lot of domestic abuse metaphors. I mean, it's dealing with a lot of social ills through a horror lens, which I always find a really interesting way to do it. And even a lot of elements of, you know, what constitutes success within a really limited scope within, you know, really closed off or urban, like, setting where there's not many avenues available to you. I mean, when JD is possessing Isaac and his, you know, he realizes that an old rival of his, who's played by Louis Gossett Jr., is a preacher now, he immediately laughs at the hypocrisy of it. but there's, you know, that what I find most interesting about the blaxploitation era, I mean, as much as the films, like, we joke about, like, the lingo and the fashions, like, how stereotypical it can be, it was also venues to really deal with, to really look through a metaphorical lens at what it was like to, you know, be an African-American in the 1970s, what it was like to live in, New York or, you know, Chicago, Cooley High was set in the Cabrini Green project. So, like, I mean, there's a level of specificity to these films, like, in terms of the setting, like, you know, the details of the lives they're viewing that is really interesting. I mean, you wouldn't call it, like, it's not like Killer of Sheep, it's not like a Cinema Verite kind of thing, but, and obviously everything is skewed through that exploitation lens, but I just find it's such a specific world that I always find it endlessly fascinating to see how these films were commenting on that part, on what that kind of life was like.
Yeah, and you know, and it, I'm surprised that, you know, it was held exclusively to, I guess, the 70s. I mean, you didn't have much in the terms of 60s, and it didn't really extend into the 80s a whole lot. But, you know, there was just this awakening, I guess you want to call it, in the 70s that was like, hey, you know, there's an untapped just social setting going on here. This is, you wanted to make movies. Movies have always wanted to be, I guess, inclusive, and they just, Hollywood is pumping out movies. They want everybody to enjoy them because, you know, it's just all about the bottom line. You want to have as many people as you can come out to see your movie and spend some money. And so, you know, especially after the civil rights movement, you know, you had this awakening that, you know, hey, there's just potential here for some more material. And so I really think that opened up the doors for, you know, black cinema to offer up their own. I mean, we've had action films, we've had horror films. I was going to say that there's not really much in terms of science fiction, in terms of black films. I mean, you've got The Brother from Another Planet, which came out in the 80s. But of course, it was written and directed by John Sayles, not a black guy. And so basically, you know, one of the movies that I want to bring now, it's from the horror genre, and it takes an old legend and something that had become very cliched in terms of Hollywood cinema. That's the vampire film. So I'm going to select Blackula from the blaxploitation subgenre as well as the horror subgenre, because this was definitely a different take on the vampire film. You know, Blackula, and he was a smooth talking character as well, you know, in the film, and so this was not in a gothic setting. This was in a very urban setting, you know, and a very 70s feel to it. And so Blackula was definitely another interesting product of its time. And basically, it opened the door for other films. There was a sequel called Scream, Blackula, Scream. You also had Blackenstein. Sugar Hill is a good one.
Yeah.
And so, but Blackula, I think, really was the front runner, the forebearer of that, you know, black horror subgenre.
Oh, absolutely. I'm pretty sure if it wasn't the first, it was the most notable. I mean, JD's Revenge wasn't until 76. Blackula was 72. You know, predating most of the other ones we think of. And of course, there's Abby from 74, the Black Exorcist ripoff with Blackula himself. William Marshall as the priest. And yep. I think there's a couple of things I love. Blackula is representative of a couple of the reasons I love, like, these kind of like blaxploitation films in general, but black horror films, because it takes the Dracula myth, but gives it, you know, an anti-hero spin before that was really commonplace for us to do. Like, you know, Blackula, he was, before Dracula himself turned him into a vampire, he was an African prince. He was a noble diplomat. And, you know, this is, I think what you were talking about, Hollywood wants films to be inclusive and accessible. They do that sort of by telling the audience what they want. Like, you know, if they pick up on a trend, they'll, you know, run with that. But by and large, they just, here's our film. We've put in enough elements that we think are likable for a wide enough audience, and we've excised all the elements that are, you know, disturbing or alienating in some way. Exploitation films, one of the reasons I think there's value there is that they keep spotting that they're more adaptable. They keep spotting niches. They don't have to appeal to everyone. They just have to appeal to one crowd really well. So, like, you know, blaxploitation films, in most cases, were about, you know, letting a black audience have heroes and heroines for once, and anti-heroes like Blackula. I mean, it's not so, like, at best, like, black actors would be, like, you know, maybe one of, like, 17 soldiers in a big-budget war film.
Right, yeah.
Like, unless it was, like, an actual, like, earnest, angry message film, you know, you weren't going to... Hollywood films weren't going to, like, look at black issues. They, you know, every now and then, especially during the Civil Rights Movement, they might, or something like the Defiant Ones, say. But by and large, they weren't going to fill that niche. Hollywood doesn't really fill niches; it just tries to appeal, be as appealing as possible. Exploitation films work on a smaller scale where they can fill those niches. I think that's why, like, a lot of people lambaste exploitation films, especially, like, you know, I realize talking about blaxploitation and we're both, you know, white as hell, is kind of a fraught thing. It's the kind of thing that Tumblr might look askance at, but you know, I think there's real value to this era of film, even though there's a level of you know, performative blackness to it, or, you know, whatever, or, you know, performative lesbianism to, like, some of the sexploitation or woman in prison films or what have you. There's a level at which it is fair to call some of the stuff stereotypical, obviously. But
right.
I think it was filling a niche that hadn't been served, and this needed to happen before we could get films that were, I guess, filling that niche in a way that was more politically correct.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, and that's probably why, come the 80s, the 70s, and the 80s, and I guess there was some integration there, I guess, so to speak, because, you know, you look at some of the films in the 80s, like, you know, 48 Hours, we mentioned Lethal Weapon earlier, and Beverly Hills Cop, and we started, now we've got, you know, African-American actors taking the forefront, and I think really the blaxploitation movement in the 70s probably played a big part in ushering in that idea.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, a lot of the black actors will be, like, commonplace in Hollywood in the 80s come for this. I mean, Louis Gossett Jr., perfect example. I mean, you've got an honest-to-God Oscar winner who was in J.D.'s Revenge. It's honestly not too much different from saying, hey, Jamie Foxx won an Oscar, but before that he was in Booty Call. So, Mario Van Peebles, he's on The Cosby Show, which, of course, television, by that point, well, when you think of 80s television, Cosby's one of the first things you think of,
yeah.
Other issues with Bill Cosby aside. But, you know, Mario Van Peebles, you know, not only a blaxploitation actor, but son of one of the preeminent, weird, sort of abrasive indie blaxploitation era directors, Melvin Van Peebles.
Melvin Van Peebles, yeah, Sweet Sweetback's badass song.
Yeah, I mean, you know, probably the film that I think more than anything launched blaxploitation.
Yeah. So, yeah, a couple of good examples there of that subgenre, and probably a couple in terms of influential as well. And moving on, I've got I want to step into the Mondo realm here. The Mondo realm, you know, you've got there were more documentary-style films. I guess you could say they were your somewhat reality-based films. But this one that I'm going to recommend was meant to make people actually think it was real, and it wasn't. For the most part, it was not. I'm going to bring in the Faces of Death here for another pick. I mean, this is from the late 70s, and it really picked up steam in the VHS era, you know, with Reynolds in the early to mid 80s. It developed like a cult following. Basically, the Faces of Death claims to be all about footage of actual deaths at the time that they are occurring, you know, grisly, violent deaths. In reality, these were very amazingly well done and created makeup and special effects to make it look real. It actually did fool a lot of people into thinking that they were real deaths caught on camera. Of course, the irony is that there is actually one death on the film that is real, and it was culled from newsreel archives. Basically, it's a man on a bicycle. I believe he's being hit by a train, and that was actual footage that the filmmakers used or found and used in the film. Everything else in the film is fake. Now, if you've never seen The Faces of Death, if you've got a weak stomach, I do not recommend that. Even though a lot of it is very creative use of makeup and special effects, it's not recommended for those with a weak stomach. You got to have an iron stomach on this one, and don't eat anything before watching it. And basically, The Faces of Death is something, and it became so popular that I believe they made 5, maybe more, of these. And then dwindling popularity. I think once the gimmick was caught on to, they dwindled in popularity with subsequent films. But this was one that, you know, a lot of people in the early days of VHS were like thinking that they were discovering like a whole new realm of movie style. The Mondo realistic caught on camera type film. This is so The Faces of Death would be my choice.
Yeah, and we mentioned it a little bit during our very first episode, during the, you know, Umberto Lenzi episode. Just that, you know, I think the Faces of Death is an interesting cultural moment. I mean, it was probably bigger on VHS than it was during its initial release. But you know, this kind of thing was already in the air throughout the 70s. I think the first use of the term snuff movie was in one of the books about the Charles Manson family, and where, you know, they had claimed the Manson family had recorded some of their murders. I don't think that was ever proven like accurate. I don't think anything's ever been found, but that the snuff film idea started really caught on memetically around then, to the point where you got, in of course 76, one of the more infamous films of this era was Snuff, the film that claimed it was made in, you know, could only be made in South America where life is cheap.
Yeah, I remember talking about that film, and no one could really accurately trace the trace the filmmakers or the people in the movie to verify.
Yeah, I think they did. They did do a some kind of government inquiry into that, and I don't think they found anything. I don't think they ended up finding anything about anything illegal about the film. Just more clever exploitation, like the Guinea Pig series or whatever. But you're also in an era where, of course, the news is showing brutal stuff. I mean, especially in Vietnam. I mean, there's famous photojournalism with absolutely brutal scenes, like Buddhist monks setting themselves on fire in protest. I mean, right around this time, mid-70s, you've got the fairly infamous on-screen suicide of Christine Chubbuck, the news anchor from Florida. Yeah,
that's right.
And which I believe just got made. I had one or two movies this past year or so, one documentary, I think, and one, fictional film about her. This idea of death being captured on film for people to see and even to be commodified is really becoming mimetic by the 70s. I don't know if that's so much because of the Mansons, because of the news journalism surrounding Vietnam, if it's because that people are actually using the news as a platform to kill themselves. Like, it seems to be in the air a lot in the 70s, and yeah, I think honestly it probably would have sort of faded away had it not been for the VHS boom.
Yeah, and this also precedes something like YouTube. I mean, back in then they didn't have YouTube. Oh my goodness, what are they going to do without YouTube in the 70s? That there are people, on YouTube and other, video sites like that, that are still curious about, finding situations like this. It's like a train wreck. People, if there's a chance of seeing someone actually getting killed live on camera, there are going to be people who want to seek it out. And, YouTube and other sites that have made that possible.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube is pretty heavily controlled where stuff like that is concerned. But, I mean, stuff like that, once it's on the internet, never goes away. I mean, the internet was first becoming accessible in most American homes, or at least a relatively large amount of American homes, you got shock sites. You end up with shock sites like Rotten.com, and that stuff only became more. That stuff only became more prevalent when, internet speeds increased. I think it's really sort of not quite disappeared. It's just kind of faded now. I think the novelty wore out, and I don't know why in particular. There was probably a rush of that kind of thing around 9/11, around the time Al Qaeda was beheading journalists and sending videos around. But now we're just sort of numb to that stuff again.
Yeah, I guess I mentioned something on the previous show about being desensitized to violence because of having watched so much of it growing up, and I guess it falls under that.
Yeah, I think like that sort of morbid inclination, it comes and it goes. Like, I think generally speaking, it comes on younger people who are just like becoming acquainted really with the reality and idea of death, and it's one way of sort of attuning themselves to what it means. And once they start maturing, it's sort of like the fascination is gone.
Yeah, and thankfully.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you got, Joe?
What could possibly follow Faces of Death?
Yeah, what could follow the Faces of Death? What's Joel got?
I'm going to follow Faces of Death with one of the possibly least scary horror films of all time. And that's a favorite of mine, Graydon Clark's Satan's Cheerleaders.
That sounds awesome.
It is amazing. I mean, it's also a film with a very good cast, all slumming it. John Ireland and Yvonne DiCarlo, Lily Munster herself, John Carradine. I mean, it's pretty intentionally tongue-in-cheek. It's a horror comedy. There's a lot of skeevy stuff in this, like a creepy school janitor stalking these cheerleaders, and they're on their way to a game, and their car breaks down. They end up accosted by a satanic cult who is trying to impregnate one of them with Satan, I believe. It happens. every now and then, everyone has these moments where someone close to them, a cult kidnaps and tries to rebirth Satan through them. It's just happens to the best of us. Here's another one. We mentioned Dean Cundey earlier with the No Mercy Man. Here's another one that he did the cinematography for, by the way.
Yeah, he's well-respected and very, henceforth, a very busy guy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he later worked with Graydon Clark on Angel's Revenge, I believe. I'd say his big breakthrough was probably Halloween, I'm sure. But, he cut his teeth on these kinds of real cheap exploitation films. And Graydon Clark's one of my favorites because his stuff is always... is always energetic and fun and, just dumb enough to, like, watch no matter how tired you are or for, our non-straight edges in the audience, how inebriated you are. Complete stupid popcorn flicks that are absolutely fun and kind of sleazy sometimes and just... totally ridiculous, and Satan's Cheerleaders is just a riot of hilarious half-assed, double entendres and some good actors slumming it and young actresses just trying to do their best with lines that no human being could possibly deliver. Just absolutely asinine and fun the entire way through.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Let's get into a couple of killer animal flicks. I mean, because you had Jaws come out in 1975. And, of course, the killer animal movie was not just... it didn't exist. It didn't not exist before Jaws, but Jaws definitely, broke the door open. And it lent itself to other filmmakers... trying to find ways to take Jaws and apply the same concept to Land, and I think we've got a couple of good ones here. What do you got in the killer animal genre there, Joel?
Well, for the killer animal genre, I went with a classic insect killer animal film, which is 1978's The Bees.
The Bees. My goodness, The Bees.
The Bees. Even before Nick Cage dealt with bees. The Bees, I mean, there's a lot of killer bee films out there. I would definitely... if you're looking for, a really fun, quick one, because you don't want to sit through the god 2 hours or so of The Swarm...
Yeah.
The Bees by Alfredo Zacharias, who did Demonoid, the film about the killer possessed satanic hand, which I don't think is nearly as good or as fun as The Bees, partly because The Bees is another example of good actors slumming it, starring John Saxon, and you've got John Carradine in there too. And, they're giving it their all because, they're goddamn professionals. But it's just every scene in this film, you just can't get past the notion that the problem would be solved if only everyone wasn't a moron, which kind of killer animal film.
Yeah, God bless the morons, because they make movies fun and interesting.
Yeah, like every bee attack could have been foiled by common sense, but it's just complete chaos as soon as one bee shows up.
I mean, at the beginning of the film, you've got the one guy breaking into, I don't know what it's called, but he breaks in where they're keeping all the killer bees. And he's looking, he's trying to steal honey, right? And you know, he just, it just goes crazy from there. Just one little innocent, thing like that, and the guy's kid is killed, and he comes back with the villagers looking to torch the place because the bees killed his son. I mean,
one little innocent like honey heist and total chaos. I mean, I don't know when exactly we discovered the existence of killer bees, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was around this time, because there were a number of bee films in the 70s.
Yeah.
Of course, that's a common thread with killer animal films as environmental and scientific concerns. I just looked up the Africanized bee, the killer bee, was first introduced in Brazil in the 50s to increase honey production, but by 57, a bunch of swarms escaped quarantine, and they were spreading throughout South America at this time, and finally got to North America in the mid-80s. So they took their time, but they got there.
It's
a genuinely realistic thing to be concerned about. I mean, crossbreeding animals usually doesn't have, repercussions that dire, but bees are already pretty dangerous, and plenty of people are allergic to them. I mean, they're probably not what you'd call an invasive species, but I don't know, the way killer bees spread throughout the Americas, they might actually be considered as such. So it's a realistic concern. Luckily, this film handles it in the least realistic way possible. Because at one point, I believe they attack a parade that is being led by stock footage of Gerald Ford.
Yes, that is... Oh, my goodness. There are just so many things we could pick about this film. Of course, my favorite being, I mentioned this earlier, just when the two hoodlums are trying to rob the woman in the elevator, and she's got bees with her, and she drops the bees, and the bees start attacking the guys, and there's no escape, so I must jump through this window. And one of my all-time favorite movie tropes is just people willingly throwing themselves through windows.
How else are you going to escape bees?
Yeah, I'll jump through this window and the bees will just stop following me, and the bees will give up. All right, he's gone through the window. Let's turn around.
Yeah, everything about the bees is great, but the way they start to communicate with the bees through the scientific advancements of John Carradine, and I would be remiss in neglecting to mention Angel Tompkins, the female lead in this, who's probably best known because she was kind of a would-be sex symbol in the early 70s, co-starring with a lot of like big actors at the time, Elliot Gould and Gene Hackman, guys like that. By this point, she was in a lot of exploitation flicks, some classic sexploitation flicks like The Teacher. She acquits herself as well as anybody possibly could in this. I can't offhand think of any really embarrassing moments for her in this. There probably are, but nothing quite like John Saxon doing doing karate practice in the middle of a scene in his bathrobe.
Yeah. Oh, like I said, there's so many things we could pull out of this movie and just analyze and make fun of it. But it's just. It's best to be remembered on the whole. We'll pick apart a few scenes, but the bees is one of those movies that you have to see at least once.
You just gotta experience the bees. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a bee attack on the United Nations.
Yeah. So the only thing missing was a lost in time Nicolas Cage just suddenly showing up going, oh my God, the bees, not the bees.
Oh my God. Luckily for all of us, I think, luckily Gerald Ford was unharmed.
He probably fell down a flight of stairs.
Oh, too soon.
Well, I've got another doozy, though, Joel, and this would have made a fine double bill back in the day. But I'm going with Orca.
Orca!
The killer whale. You know, we talked about Jaws earlier, and, you know, in 1987 gave us Jaws the Revenge. But before that, the idea of an animal, or, I'm sorry, a mammal, capable of revenge was, you know, a bit of a foreign concept, you know, before Jaws the Revenge. And Orca was one of those movies that kind of preceded that. And what do you think? Do you think an animal is capable of seeking revenge, Joel?
If they're not, I'm very disappointed with the world.
Oh, so, I mean, we've got Richard Harris as a fisherman who harpoons the mate. We'll call the whale Orca. We'll call the main antagonist Orca, for lack of a better, since that's what's the name of the movie, you know, that's the title. So anyway, Orca's mate is harpooned and miscarries Orca's baby. Meanwhile, Orca is standing off in the distance watching all of this, whining and crying about it. So eventually Orca gets pissed and seeks revenge, and it's doing things like, you know, destroying fishing boats and shorting out, everyone's electricity. And at one point Orca literally moves an iceberg onto a boat in order to destroy it. I mean, this is one smart whale. And I guess when you're seeking revenge, when you're a whale and you seek revenge, you have to be smart about it. And then the scene where the whale just flips Richard Harris with its tail into an iceberg. This is another, much like the bees, if you need to see a killer whale movie at least once in your life, you make it Orca. And it's definitely making my list just for the kitschiness of it all. It's a fun movie, despite the silliness of it. You actually sit there. It's just a fun movie to watch. You know, watching all of this unbelievable stuff happening in regards to the whale and whether the whale can actually, you know, has the capability to exact revenge.
You know, Orca, there's nothing I don't love about Orca, but I love the incredible gap between how it presents itself and what it is, because it wants to be this, like, epic Moby Dick adventure tale of obsession and, you know, environmental exploitation and, you know, coming face to face with the effect you've had on the world around you. It wants to be that so bad, and it's so posturing. It's so puffing its chest out. Like, it opens with a killer whale killing a great white shark, as if to say, we're the big fish on the block, Jaws. get the hell out of our sea. Like, And, you know, here's the thing. It's a lot of talented people. Michael Anderson directed this, who did, you know, journeyman filmmaker, probably. Like, a lot of really exceptional films he's done. Around the World in 80 Days, Logan's Run, which is a personal favorite of mine. I mean, it's just, there's such a gap between what Orca wants to be and what Orca is. And I don't know if that's largely due to the script, if that's just because, you know, De Laurentiis was behind all of this and he wanted more and more ridiculous aspects to it. I mean, you know, it was written by Luciano, I'm terrible Italian pronunciations, Vincenzoni, who wrote for A Few Dollars More in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I mean, you know, I don't. It's hard to separate those films from the directorial style, so I don't know, like, if I'm necessarily evaluating the script as well as I could be. But, I mean, two of the greatest Westerns of all time. He also did Fistful of Dynamite, if I believe, and Death Rides a Horse, and a million spaghetti Westerns, all of which were good. Like, so the right people were on this. It doesn't seem like it should be as disastrous as it ended up being.
Yeah, it's kind of, you hit on a point there with the screenwriting. It's kind of like Jaws, if it was, no, well, not Jaws, but it's kind of like a killer whale movie if it was a spaghetti Western.
It is. Oh, my God. Yeah. There's, like, the showdown between Orca and Richard Harris, it's like Lee Van Cleef and Clint Eastwood, like having a showdown. Like, oh, my God, I can't believe I didn't even think of that. I'm really excited now. That's it.
The show's over. Joel's got to go.
Joel's got to go watch Orca like 15 times. Orca, like I was telling you earlier, led to my all-time favorite movie reaction from anybody, which is on a VH1's I Love the 70s episode with Orca, where Patrice O'Neill nearly collapses on the floor laughing so hard because he's just recounting what happened in Orca.
Yeah, that's going to be a genuine reaction of most people who watch this movie. If you have not seen Orca, go find it, seek it out, watch Orca, and just be amazed. Keep your eyes glued. You're going to be blown. Your mind's going to be blown. You're going to be picking up pieces of your brain off the floor.
Also,
see Orca.
If you ever get the chance to look at the movie poster of Orca, it's like a novel on the movie poster. This is a film that's so hard, like trying to be a great thing so hard. There's two paragraphs of text on the movie poster explaining what a killer whale is and how smart it is and how much it loves its mate.
They needed three posters side by side in the movie theater just to explain it.
No, you need one of those giant cardboard cutouts they have in movie theaters now.
Yeah. Moving on. I've got another one here before. I've got one more before I get to my ultimate 70s exploitation recommendation. And this one is another one that's got a little bit of everything. It's got a lot of sleaze, a lot of wacky scientific experiments. There's sexploitation and there's Nazi exploitation, and I'm going to recommend Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. And if you've not seen this film, Ilsa is a commandant, a Nazi commandant, who she's conducting crazy off-kilter experiments trying to prove that women make better soldiers than men because they can tolerate pain more. But the other thing about Ilsa is that she has a a voracious appetite for men, and if they can't satisfy her, she has them castrated. I'm just gonna flat out say that it's very typical 70s, you know, exploitation drive-in movie with a lot of controversial elements to it. And if I was to, you know, some people give star ratings to their movies. This one I'm probably going to give not a star rating, but a shower rating. This one's probably 4.5 showers worth. To once you've seen it, that's how long it. That's how many showers you're going to need to clean up after seeing it. It's kind of notorious from the era. I'm not going to say it's a forgotten film because it certainly makes the rounds in public screenings and festivals and things of that nature. So it's definitely notorious. It's well known, and I don't want to get into too much of it, but there's a lot of this thing would not get made today if it was made in the same with the same tone and same plot elements. This thing would not get made today. There's no way that this would pass the MPAA board. No theater would carry this thing. This was definitely something that was found in many a drive-in back in the day. You've got, I mean, Nazis, you've got nudity, you've got sex, and you've got all kinds of sleazy, scummy, you know, things throughout the film. So, and I'm going to one-up that one a little bit shortly here, but this is definitely on the short list of very, shall we say, messy, exploitative, you know, subgenre films.
Well, yeah, what is it about Nazi woman that's just so sexy? I mean, you've got Ilsa, you've got Matilda the Hun in Death Race 2000, you've got Ivanka Trump, seriously, it's a fascinating. So Ilsa is a film that I think probably people have talked about more than they've seen. Partly because it's the film that like people think the idea of it is kind of fascinating, but wouldn't necessarily like want to see it. But I mean that weird sort of kink that's very visible in culture, like even in less obvious forms. I mean, when you think of like 80s children's television, like, and female characters that guys grew up with a crush on, one of the first you think of is the Baroness from G.I. Joe.
I see where you're going with that.
That sort of weird exploitation kink is somehow ingrained in our pop culture. I mean, probably not to the extent that, like, I don't know, like a schoolgirl fetish or something, a nurse fetish would be, but like the fact that the, you know, dominatrix, like vaguely foreign, vaguely fascist commandant woman is a recurring trope in our culture, I find endlessly fascinating. And I mean, it might just be connected to sort of the sadistic lesbian women's prison warden trope, which go on.
No, I was just going to say that they actually made several Ilsa films, like The Tigress of Siberia. She was also in something called The Sadistic Warden, I think. I want to say that might be one of the titles of another. But yeah, exactly. She's this character had three or four films revolving around her. But She-Wolf of the SS is the one that stands out the most because of the way really it, I think it exploited men more than anything else. Basically, she treated them as pieces of meat, and if they didn't satisfy her, she put them through the grinder, so to speak.
Which is that weird sort of push-pull dynamic that, you know, attraction-repulsion thing that makes for so many, like, it makes for so many kinks in these kinds of films.
Yeah.
And I always find this interesting to talk about because it's so outside my realm of experience, because I'm so, like, I spent my childhood crushing on, like, you know, nice girls and, like, nerd girls. Like, so the idea of, like, really getting off on, like, not, like, statuesque Nazi commandant whipping you is just so, like, such a foreign idea to me. It might as well be like finding a cookbook titled To Serve Man.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
But like, yeah, I think she's sort of a very specific version of that, like, you know, that sadistic female warden type. And, you know, a lot of male prison films have sadistic warden types. It's just when prisoners are your main characters, the warden is an obvious antagonist. But that brings me to my my next choice, Jack Hill's Woman in Prison classic, The Big Birdcage.
All right.
Which of course has a lot of staples of the woman in prison genre. Vic Diaz, Pam Grier, of course, Anitra Ford. Unfortunately, it does not have Roberta Collins, Matilda the Hun herself, who was in the predecessor of this, The Big Dollhouse. But it also has Sid Haig in one of my favorite early performances of his, has a very lazy South American revolutionary.
Yeah, Sid Haig, you know, for those who aren't familiar with him, this was, you know, quite common. The movie appeared in most common, like I'm just talking about the low budget B movie. He was a good character actor for these type of films, and he usually played probably one of the most. He was usually the most serious guy in the film.
Yeah, here's a like sort of an exception for Sid, because he's not totally heroic. He's kind of a self-interested mercenary, but in that charming roguish way that like those characters can often be depicted. And of course he's Pam Grier's lover, which is already, you're straining the bounds of realism with that one. But there's a brilliant moment where she's complaining, you know, she's with him because she bought into the hype that he was like this great like Che Guevara, like, you know, Pancho Villa revolutionary, and she's bugging him about when's the revolution going to happen. He's in a hammock with his hat shading his eyes, saying, "Tomorrow, baby, tomorrow." they have insane chemistry together. I mean, you know, if you're getting into exploitation films, like, you gotta watch A Good Woman in Prison. Jack Hill ones. I mean, there's a requisite seediness, but there's a playfulness to Jack Hill's stuff. Like, you know, he's gonna get like, you know, it's gonna be exploitative, but you know, he's never gonna like be really grotesque about it. There's just a sense of goofiness to it that, like, even in the like really wild, strange moments, it feels more like a weird romp than anything, and I think this, more than any of his other Woman in Prison films, really hits that tone.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, The Big Birdcage, basically, you know, with the Women in Prison film subgenre, I guess the front runner in this subgenre would be The Big Birdcage.
Yeah, I think that's what, I mean, you know, discounting some of the ones that use the setting for, you know, a revenge plot, like the you know, Female Prisoner Scorpion, of course, which, you know, Miko Kaji is, you know, the I think the all-time great heroine of the exploitation era. You know, if for a traditional woman in prison film that's not so skeevy you want to take like 4.5 showers afterwards, you can't go wrong with Big Birdcage. I actually talked to Sid Haig at a convention about this not long ago, where he was saying, to his knowledge, that he is Pam Grier's first on-screen kiss.
Well, that's something.
I mean, which blows my mind. I mean, there might be an example of that beforehand, but just like the insanity of Sid Haig and Pam Grier being put together as a couple, and the fact that it works so goddamn well. I mean,
yeah.
That's the Jack Hill difference right there. That he can do something completely insane. It feels like just like a natural outgrowth of the story, and it's a hell of a lot of fun too.
Yeah, Sid was definitely over his pay grade there with Pam. Yeah. Well, I think what we'll do, Joel, we'll get to the end here. We've got a couple of recommendations. It's kind of like the double bill spill. We're going to recommend each of us a film in the exploitation genre. I think we'll have you start it off with your choice, and then we'll get to mine to close the show. I've got a little reason for doing that, but we'll get into that in just a moment. But you go ahead.
Well, my choice is Gurley from 1970, which is a little early in the exploitation genre, and it's one of the rare examples of what you might consider an English exploitation film. It's directed by Freddie Francis, who I think most people would know best as one of Hammer's directors. I mean, he did Dracula's Risen from the Grave. He, of course, did Tales from the Crypt, The Creeping Flesh. You know, I think still unreleased on home format Son of Dracula with Harry Nilsson, which I think is still in limbo because of the music rights, because Harry's stuff was under Apple, the Beatles record label, and Ringo Starr is actually playing Merlin in Son of Dracula.
Right. Yeah.
But if Freddie's done like classier stuff, like Frankenstein and Dracula films, and he's done grindier stuff. I always find his back and forth in tone and style really interesting. I mean, he does stuff that like fits right in the middle in that perfect like camp wavelength, like Trog with Joan Crawford. but Gurley is a fascinating film that's almost like one of his occasional indulgences into satire. This guy gets kidnapped by a British family who's like a very weird, skewed version of British manners. They don't have, like, the father's gone, so it's like a mother and maid and two children who are not actually children. They're like in their 20s and they act like children, which is already, of course, weird enough. But you know, he's recruited to sort of be the children's playmate. Like he's like the new kid there. And of course, all the games are like these very sort of dangerous, you know, cat and mouse things. And he ends up trying to upend the whole family dynamic by trying to seduce the mother and the daughter. And it's just a strange, you know, mad family film in the vein of Spider Baby, but it's a really actually funny film. I mean, I'm not as clued in as probably a lot of viewers and readers might be to the, despite how much I've seen a lot of British films, read a lot of British novels, but I still, like, I'm not British, so I might not be as clued in to like the subtleties of like the stuff he's parodying in this movie, but I think he does a good enough job of communicating it to a general audience to get across the sort of parody comedy of man. So it's just a really interesting take on the exploitation, the like insane family film, especially because insane family films tend to be these sort of like, especially American exploitation, tend to be like Trailer Park Families, or Mutant Families, very Hills Have Eyes, very Texas Chainsaw. So exactly. I find it funny that the British equivalent is sort of like a wealthy family, because because that seems to be a very British like mode, the crazy people are, the insanity is all in like the royal family. Everyone on the street is trying to survive. Here in America, we assume like the crazy people are all in the swamps.
Well, it's true, isn't it?
Probably. I don't know. I haven't been to the swamps in a while. But no, it's just awesome seeing following Freddie's career and seeing him go from like Hammer stuff to sleaze and back again, and really like do like constantly modulate his style to fit the material. I just find it really interesting how he does that. And there's a lot of very like weird, funny, sing-songy stuff. Like there's a lot of like there's a real like nursery rhyme quality to some of the stuff in here, but really skewed. It is very like, it's skeevy, but it's not like, you know, I'm not by nature a very sleazy dude, I guess, which is to my constant disappointment. So like, it's not Ilsa, but it is still weird enough to make you uncomfortable. It's not gonna totally like swick you out, but there's a lot of weird shit in this movie.
Well, you speaking of weird shit, that's gonna bring me to my recommendation.
Yeah.
And we're going to finally give the little devil his due at this point. We've got a ton of sleaze. We've got captive women. We've got drugs. We've got a very unholy use of a cane. And finally, we're giving the sinful dwarf his due. We finally done it, Joel. We finally got the sinful dwarf on the show.
We finally got there.
You know, so the dwarf, his name is Olaf, and he's very fond of wind-up toys, which he gets from a store that is owned by a guy that he calls Santa Claus. He's a fat, bearded guy. But the store is a front for drug dealing. And the drugs are stored inside the wind-up toys. So Olaf lives with his mother. And so the drugs are stuffed inside the wind-up toys, and they take them out and they sell the drugs. But at the same time, Olaf and his mother are fond of taking women and holding them captive to sell them for sexual pleasure to strange men who come by and pay them money to do so. And so at one point in time, a married couple come by seeking out a room because they're new in town, and the husband of the couple is he's a writer, and he's trying to sell his stuff to editors. And basically, they happen to rent a room from Olaf and his mother. And, of course, Olaf is very fascinated with the woman, so much so that he has a little peephole in their bedroom, and he watches them do what, you know, couples will do. So we get a lot of, you know, nudity and sex in this movie at this point. But the secret is that they have secret entrance off their attic that holds women that they've got chained up. And they are shooting drugs into them and basically selling them to men. And so we get the inevitable capture of the young woman from the couple, and they play it off as they leave a little note for the husband saying that she's left him because she can't take him not having a job anymore and whatnot. And so the search is on for her while she's actually hidden away in the attic in the very same building. And this movie is, even everything sleazy about the exploitation genre of the 70s, and it is in this film. The sexploitation, the drug use, the treatment of women. This is what I'm going to call a five shower movie. This is if you don't have a stomach for, you know, this sort of thing, then of course I'm not going to recommend it to you. But if you're interested in seeing just how sleazy the 70s can get, then The Sinful Dwarf is the movie for you.
Oh, I kind of need a shower just after the plot synopsis, honestly.
Yeah, so, you know, we gotta end the gag sometime, Joel. So we may as well end it with actually getting the sinful dwarf on the show. We got the right genre. You got the right topic for it. And so I'm glad to say that I finally got this monkey off my back, and I've recommended the sinful dwarf.
It's a fair recommendation. I mean, how often are we gonna get to recommend an exploitation film where there's a plushie of the main character?
Yes, there's a sinful dwarf plushie. If you go on Google and search sinful dwarf plushie, you'll find it. Now he's a lot cuter than he is in the movie. And in the movie, Olaf is played by a dwarf actor named Torben. He only gets one name. He's not tall enough for two names. And he's just this maniacal, drooling thing that's just very creepy, is the best way to put it. It's quite a very convincing performance, actually.
Oh, man. And, yeah, that's... that is a minor subgenre of 70s exploitation we didn't really get into, is dwarf sport exploitation. I mean,
I guess this is
typically, it wasn't like, it's a side element of, you know, a lot of uses of what we might call sideshow attractions or freaks in these kinds of films.
Yeah.
And the simple dwarf is probably the major example, but I mean, there's a lot of films out there that, you know, just has like a bonus, just cast a dwarf actor, like for your height only, the dwarf kung fu film.
Oh, are we talking about Wang Wang, the Filipino dwarf?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, he's very he's very well known in the B movie circuit for these films. I mean, I think he's even shorter than Torben in The Sinful Dwarf. I mean, that was probably the teeniest guy I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think he's got the Wang Wang has the world record for shortest lead actor.
You know, just one more thing about The Sinful Dwarf. I mean, it's not just sleazy, but it's also bizarre. In the fact that, you know, the character, his mother. Hang on. All right, sorry about that. This is right at the end, so it shouldn't be that bad. I just had to kick a cat out of the room.
Oh.
Anyway, the mother character is a former cabaret singer, and so a couple of times in the movie she throws on a costume and she busts out a cabaret tune while Olaf the dwarf plays piano for her. So, you know, it's also bizarre to go along with the sleaze and the and just the downright just nastiness of this film. Like I said, this is a five shower movie. It may even be six. So this is definitely just, if you're going to watch The Sinful Dwarf, just, you know, don't draw a bath, because you'll be wallowing in your own filth after that.
If you're going to watch The Sinful Dwarf, don't. I think is where we should, where I would leave it. But no, I think that's one of the things that I think what we can leave the audience with is, it's not just that the sleaziness that I think makes these films notable. I mean, we talked about how they were for different audiences with black exploitation, with, like, say, Ozploitation being, you know, an independent version of a country's nascent film industry. But I think one of the things that always, you know, can never fail to fascinate me is how absolutely bizarre some of the ideas in these films are. I mean, it's not enough to make a film called The Sinful Dwarf and have a dwarf be sinful. Like, they go above and beyond. I mean, yeah. that's what I love.
And I think that's what, the films were made with that in mind, in order to, you know, push them out to the grindhouse theaters and the drive-in theaters to get people to see them. You know, they were, you know, just, I'm not going to say they were creative, but it was just, you know, taking everyone's worst nightmares, I guess, and just throwing it on the screen. And, you know, the more masochistic among us would be the ones to go see them. That's probably the best way I can put it. And I guess that will wrap up this show. I hope you've enjoyed our little foray down memory lane towards the 70s and some of the genre films from that era. It was certainly fun to recall most of these. So I always remember your mom and pop video store, because a lot of these movies were found on the dusty shelves in the back of the store. And recall them, as much as we're doing here, regardless of the content of the film, it's just a trip down memory lane that is worth visiting once or twice. So until next week, I'm Chris Jordan. He's Joe LaPuma. Thank you for joining us, and join us next week for another trip down memory lane to your mom and pop video store. We'll see you next week. Thank you.